I've eaten humble pie to realize I may have a good idea, I may know the patient need, but creating a business, changing something from an idea to something that's executed at the bedside with a viable funding stream and so on and so forth, is a whole other game.
When a physician gives a blood test order and says, go get your blood test done, about 40% of the people just don't go do it. That implies about 50% of the population over time is walking around with a chronic condition they weren't aware of.
Movement can fix a lot of things. It may not be easy as taking a pill, but it's also has a much more robust impact on every system within the human body.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Hello, I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. The passionate commitment of healthcare and life science founders continues to inspire and amaze. We meet a lot of incredible innovators on the show, so we thought it'd be fun to do something a little different, compiling a five-part mini-series with each episode featuring a compilation of multiple companies tackling every stage of the health innovation lifecycle. If you're just joining us, make sure to check out last week's episode, the first part of the series diving into the cutting-edge world of drug research and development. Today, in part two, we explore innovations in the biomarker discovery and diagnostics space. We'll learn how Us2 AI, Truvian Health, and Sparta Science are leveraging AI, cloud, and novel biological insights to guide patients into care pathways that improve health. In the coming weeks, we'll feature clinical trials, clinician-to-patient experience, real-world evidence, and population health. Each section starts with a brief introduction to the company, followed by an excerpt from their episode on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you like what you hear and want to learn more about any of the companies, check out our show notes for a link to the complete episodes. I am really thrilled with how this episode turned out, and I hope you enjoy the compilation too. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Today, my colleague, Dr. Terrence Tan, Business Development Manager, Healthcare and Life Sciences Startups for AWS, host Dr. Carolyn Lamb and James Hare, the co-founders of Us2.ai, on the show. Us2.ai is a Singapore-based company on a mission to democratize echocardiograms through AI. They've validated their solution with groundbreaking studies across the globe, which we'll get to hear all the details about, and are making it possible for these life-saving scans to be delivered by non-specialist nurses and even non-clinicians.
Maybe what we can do is just to get you, James and Carolyn, to introduce yourselves and maybe just tell us a little bit about Us2.ai and what you all do.
Sure. I think James, being the gentleman that he is going to say ladies first. So I will go ahead first. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, and I'm based in Singapore. I'm a heart failure cardiologist and professor with Duke National University of Singapore, and really found myself being an almost accidental co-founder. And yet this is basically one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my life, to create software that I hope can really change practice in the sense of addressing many of the needs and gaps that I see in my world of heart failure, but beyond in the world of cardiology. And that is to really democratize the most commonly used tool we have to image the heart, which is ultrasound or echocardiography. Thank you so much, Terrence, for this opportunity to share today.
And thank you very much. I'm James Hare, co-founder and CEO of the company. Our mission in life is to apply AI software to automate this fight against cardiovascular disease. I'm honored to be a part of this fight and can't wait to tell you more about what we've done.
Fantastic. Well, why don't we hear a little bit more from James about the solution and what it entails?
Absolutely. Delighted to tell you more. So we started this adventure a bit accidentally. When I first got involved in this challenge, it was actually as a retired serial entrepreneur. I was very happily retired, kite surfing around the world, enjoying, frankly, the good life, when suddenly I needed an echo done. I'd had a troubling ECG and the doctor said, there might be something wrong with your heart. And when doctors worry about your heart, they need to see the heart, which means you need to get an echo done. And I ended up getting two echoes done because the first one seemed not quite on point. And so we ended up getting a second echo exam done, which gave completely different results. One echo exam said that there was something seriously wrong with my heart, and the other said that there's nothing wrong at all. This immediately triggered, despite the worrying fact that it was my heart that they were talking about, it immediately triggered the entrepreneurial instincts because it seemed like there was a lot of room for improvement in this process that I thought had been a tried and true and solved issue. Fortunately, I had the help of Carolyn, who took me into the recesses of how is echocardiography done. And what I discovered was very expensive doctors in very expensive dark rooms manually tracing the borders of echo images in order to generate measurements and using software that they all universally hated. It seemed like something from the early 80s. And then I knew there was an opportunity to improve the workflow, improve the solutions, and give people what they want, which is a process that's fast, efficient, with no variability. And that's what we did. We've created AI software. It takes what's normally a 30-minute manual error-prone process and turn it into something that in less than 2 minutes creates a complete echo report for doctors with all of the measurements done automatically, tied to all of the images that you need to see to verify that a report is accurate. And all of this is done beautifully in software that works anywhere you want it to, whether it's in the cloud, on-prem, or on mobile devices. That's what we've created.
Wonderful. Perhaps we can go to Carolyn for the clinical perspective on this solution.
Well, to be honest, when the idea first came about, you have to remember that I've trained for, oh my goodness, 5 years to become a doctor, another 5 years to be a cardiologist, and, more years after that to learn echocardiography. So you can imagine that to say AI can automate what we take so long to learn was really a hard pill to swallow. However, it was made easier because, frankly, we hate the very manual, mundane process of reading and measuring echoes. That's universal, like tracing all the outlines, like five-year-olds, and just having each person do it different and having myself do it different if you gave it to me a different day. And so I realized that what it offered was a way to take away the stuff that none of us like to do anyway. It's automating the manual stuff. Frankly, giving us more time with patients because now we can have more standardization, more precision, perhaps even earlier diagnosis by enabling people who can't do echo to do echo now. And therefore, we get more time to just be doctors, the stuff we enjoy doing. And I think I'm very grateful, in fact, that most of the community has embraced it as such now.
And perhaps a little bit of an open question to both James and Carolyn is whether do you consider us to AI a general AI clinical decision support company or a more specialized solution for the imaging, or in this case, the cardiac imaging space?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that. So we are a clinical decision support tool. It's, we work within regulated markets, and, that's the label that we have as a support tool for doctors, sonographers, et cetera, to analyze echo images. That said, what we focus on, our specialty is imaging. So we are not, a large language model. We're not a general tool. We focus on imaging, which frankly was the thing that, 5-7 years ago really accelerated the current AI hype cycle, not to the levels of where we are now with LLMs, but it's, the success people suddenly started having with just facial recognition, image recognition, just using basic AI tools to do image classification and annotations, it was huge. It was revolutionary. And we decided to take those tools and work within the domain that we know well, which is cardiology.
Well, Terrence, could I also add to that by asking you, you know about all the AI for the electrocardiogram. You might be wearing a watch that actually is telling you about your electrical rhythm of the heart. Now, is that general or is that specialized? Because I think that what we have created for Echo is exactly what happened decades ago with the electrocardiogram. You start with AI that enables the electrical squiggles to be read, and then soon it gets democratized because it's such a safe modality. And soon it's not just non-specialists who are doing the electrocardiogram, like your general practitioners, like nurses, like even just community-based screening. And now people are using it as consumer wearables. I think that this is exactly what's needed for ultrasound, that you have AI that's first used by the specialists, but soon it will enable non-specialists to do screening echoes because ultrasound is so safe. And soon, who knows, we could be doing medical heart selfies with our own AI device in our own hands.
Thank you for that. I think, although I was going to ask this question perhaps a little bit later, I think because Carolyn's brought it up about doing it by ourselves, I'd like to pull this a little bit earlier and just ask for a few comments, because I remember that there was some research from us to AI showing the accuracy of using non-professional / non-trained users in the use of echocardiography using your solution.
Oh, I hope you don't mind me starting here, James. When it comes to this, I'm just so proud and excited about the research. So one of the studies called OPERA is going to be a late-breaking trial result in Amsterdam at the European Society of Cardiology meeting at the end of this month. So I'm afraid I can't give it all away in terms of the main results. However, the study itself and its design have been discussed in the public, and especially in Glasgow, where the study was performed, included almost 800 patients and basically addressing the long echo waiting times that had accumulated during COVID, and simply by also empowering nurses to do point of care echo assisted by AI. And one of the remarkable findings was that echo wait times were reduced. Now, that's not the main result I can't talk about, but the echo wait times were certainly reduced from 1 year, that's how long it takes to get an echo in the UK, to at least weeks, only weeks. And because this was so remarkable at the time, it was discussed at the highest levels in Glasgow, even up to the parliament level. So we were very, very proud to have these sort of first examples. Since then, we've also carried out a prospective study focused at the National Heart Center in Singapore and led by Dr. Huang Wei-Ting. And what she showed is she could use AI to teach complete novices. So this time they weren't even nurses. They just were completely non-medical background, never touched an echo probe or an ultrasound probe before, and they could be trained to do heart screening. And although there was an initial learning curve, they all managed to do it with 96% feasibility and taking initially about 30 minutes, but then putting that all the way down to an average of 11 minutes per scan. So you can imagine, right? Just novices using AI, getting a heart scan and being able to accurately and predictably pick out whether there was heart failure. And so this was presented already, and our manuscript is being reviewed at a journal. And then finally, we've kind of gone one step further in Tunisia. in a study we've called the Cumin study. Again, the results have been presented at a major meeting and the manuscript is under review. But basically this time, we asked nurses to do echo screening or ultrasound screening of the heart at home, in patients' homes. And that's because with AI mobile echo, it's completely feasible to be able to go to patients' homes and do the heart screening there. And so we showed that in the Cumin study, again, something we're very proud of. So this is the evidence generation piece. We are now carrying out a large multinational study involving 5 countries, including US, Canada, UK, Denmark, and Sweden. And we are now going into the community with AI Echo. That means these are not patients that have been the focus of all the prior studies. They're not patients with known heart disease, but the general community. And we are going into the community to screen them for heart disease. It's already started. We're listed on clinicaltrials.gov, the Symphony trial, and super excited about this.
Wonderful. I think we all look forward to the results of the Symphony trial. And on that note, perhaps coming back a little bit to the flow of things, you sort of mentioned about evidence generation. Perhaps we can go back a little bit into the development phase. So perhaps here's one for James. If you could share a story of a particularly challenging technical obstacle that had to be overcome.
Oh, how long do we have? There have been many.
Perhaps the one that most comes to mind.
Okay. I mean, one that immediately jumps to top of mind is the challenge of getting 100% real automation. And what I mean by that is many of our peers in this industry claim automation, but when you actually use their tools and try to make their workflow work, a human always gets involved at some point. They always ask humans to, you know, click here or pick this view, pick the correct view or verify that the view is correct. Point of interest on the human has to touch something. And so it's actually semi-automated. And to take that next leap, to have something that produces a complete report with nobody touching anything, it's just an order of magnitude more work and more precision required to get that level of accuracy. And so that was just a huge battle that, frankly, we fought ourselves internally because there were a lot of internal discussions early on saying, well, you know, the industry's already doing this. It's semi-automated. Can't we just stop there? Isn't it enough? And we decided, no, we want to go the whole way. And why is because it guarantees if you can do that, your accuracy is so much better, which is something that we're seeing now in the field in commercial use. But also it unlocks an enormous opportunity. Because if you ask yourself, where's the supply? Where's the supply of echo images? It's the 99.99% of echo images that have already been captured, already been done, that are sitting somewhere on a server or a PACS machine somewhere. This dark data that's unused, that when it was first captured, doctors looked at manually, and when they look at things manually, they can only process about less than 5% of the information there. Whereas our software reads every frame of every video and every report. And so you can imagine it just produces tons more data. But because it can be done 100% automatically, you can just set it loose on these huge stores of data. And so we've shown it. We've got trials that we've done where we've just run our software on existing electronic health records and been able to pick out patients with heart failure that were missed when they first saw a doctor. And you can imagine that's one disease, but because we detect many diseases, our software can just go through. It never sleeps. So you can just set it running loose and pick up all the things that just get missed in the normal day due to normal human error. That was a big one.
I think just pulling on that thread just a little bit more, because when you talk about full automation and humans in the loop, perhaps for Carolyn, are there any concerns from the clinician's point of view?
To make everything even safer, because some things are standardized and automated, while keeping the human under full control, this is exactly what we're regulatory approved for, which is as decision support. In other words, we support clinicians and support people who are still there to provide the care for the patients. So I think that's just very, very critical to remind ourselves. We're not trying to remove the doctor from the equation. We're trying to superpower the doctor to do things faster, more accurately, in a more standardized way, and perhaps to even remind some of things that may be missed, which we have found time and time again happens, frankly, in routine clinical practice.
Absolutely. And perhaps just following on that, Carolyn, how does the sort of Echo Copilot change or integrate with the workflow of healthcare providers using the tool?
Oh, our Copilot is really something that we are so, so excited about and glowing each time we show it to someone in person. Literally, I wish that everybody could put their hands on it. And we have just seen time and time again that once someone uses it, the Copilot, and sees it in action, it just becomes super clear what this is all about. The Copilot literally can be attached with any hardware Echo machine, be it the big full stack machines that we have in the hospitals, or the small mobile hardware Echo machines that we can carry around with us. And basically, you just connect it to our Copilot, and as anybody is scanning a patient, you have a real-time reading and report being produced. The Copilot therefore shows also the person obtaining the images whether or not the images are good enough to get all the readings that they need. And so it is very helpful there, because one other thing that we find out in clinical practice is we hate it when we sort of a sonographer or a technician gets the images, and then when we read the echo as the echocardiologist, we realize, wait a minute, there were not enough images, or we've got to look at this side or that side or this angle. And then the patient has to be called to the lab. And so with a Copilot right next to you reporting while you're doing the echo, it makes a huge difference to the person obtaining the echo. Let's put it this way. We are now live in Uganda with a group from the US who are screening kids for rheumatic heart disease. And it's exactly using the Copilot so that while the screening is done, the report can already be generated to say, is this a normal scan or not? Is there evidence of rheumatic heart disease in these kids?
Perhaps you could share with us, in addition to this group in Uganda, a few of the customers who are currently using the solution. Perhaps this is one for James.
Sure. So, I mean, yeah, the Uganda one is, we're super proud of it. It's one of the extremes, right? I mean, just really out there doing a disease that we don't typically think about in the first world and screening for it. Another potential customer example is first world high-end customer would be the Brigham Hospital in Boston. So there, their Echo Core Lab is using our software to process more rapidly the clinical trials that they do. So, I mean, they found themselves at the limit and could not take on more work, more clinical trials without some sort of efficiency improvements. And they're using our software to increase throughput, do more automation and do more trials, which eventually, if the trials are successful, means more therapeutics for us, for the world. So that's one we're very proud about. And then maybe a third example, just to show you just how many different use cases there are. We have actually now more than one customer in the Philippines. So we've gone from Uganda to Boston to now the Philippines using our software, very interesting fashion. So they're using our software combined with mobile ultrasound devices to basically do technology leapfrogging. And by that, I mean we've seen, there are many famous cases of technology leapfrogging, such as, in China, skipping credit cards and going straight to mobile payments. And the same thing in Africa, or people everywhere using solar power to skip over, the years and decades of costs involved with, you know, energy infrastructure. This type of leapfrogging we see happening in the Philippines now allows people to jump over decades of trial and error using the expensive, bulky, six-figure ECHO machines that are manual and lead to all of the huge wait times we see, and go straight to a mobile device with an AI assistant on that device, basically putting, you know, top cardiology talent in their hands.
Imagine the next time you visit your GP that you don't have to get blood drawn and return to hear about your results a few days later. You fill out your intake form and a medical technician takes just 8 drops of blood, then a full suite of blood tests is completed in the clinic in just 30 minutes. When you meet your doctor, they have these results on hand, enabling a more streamlined care experience. Today, we welcome Jay Srinivasan, the CEO of Truvian Sciences, to the show. Truvian is working to transform blood diagnostics, a space made infamous by Theranos, but they're doing it in a completely different way. Can you introduce us to Truvian and what you all do?
Absolutely. So at Truvian, we are a blood diagnostic company, and our mission is to bring central lab testing near patients. So we want to bring the central lab, which is like the Quest and the LabCorps of the world in the United States and other labs across the world. We want to bring them near patient, implying we could actually perform the same quality of testing near you and I.
Great. And can you bring that to life in terms of what kind of patients is that going to be the most impactful for?
Absolutely. So an important piece, Alex, to the folks who are not really used to blood diagnostics or just the diagnostics industry in general, 70% of all clinical decisions, meaning decisions that doctors make, come from diagnostic testing. Yet 2% of the spend in the United States in particular goes into diagnostic testing today. But when you think about blood testing, which is the foundational kind of sample used for any sort of diagnostic today, 40% of the U.S. population, and it's pretty much the same percentages, if not more, rest of the world, just do not adhere to their blood test order. So when a physician gives a blood test order and says, go get your blood test done, about 40% of the people just don't go do it. That implies about 50% of the population over time is walking around with a chronic condition they weren't aware of. Our goal is to really be able to ensure that we can address that adherence component, which is really driven by the friction-laden nature of centralized blood testing today. So we want to be able to address that. We want to be able to address the fact that today, if you went and got your annual blood test done, you get multiple tubes of blood drawn, and then they get shipped out to central labs for testing. And blood, like any biologic, deteriorates over time and distance. And so there's a quality implication to the fact that blood testing being centralized could introduce. And our goal is to be able to provide a platform that can be placed anywhere you go. So it could be in a corporate clinic, in a retail clinic, in a building, office building, in a school, simple to use system that can be operated by someone who does not have to be a med tech. And it can allow you to actually perform blood testing near patient. And we need one tube of blood. So we actually need a lot less than one tube of blood. We need about 8 drops of 300 microliters of blood to give you your annual blood test results.
Can you describe what the patient experience is like when they use the Truvian diagnostic?
Absolutely. So we're in late stage development. When our product's out in the marketplace, the journey you're going to take is going to be very different if you're a patient who would be tested on a Truvian machine. So you'd be able to walk into a facility, either have your blood test scheduled or walk in and schedule your blood test right at the facility, have a blood order scheduled for you, get your blood drawn. It could be a standard phlebotomy if there is a phlebotomist on site, or it could be using capillary devices that are in development today that can actually deliver about 300 to 400 microliters of blood. That blood, your one tube of blood, is going to end up on a Truvian machine. And while you're waiting to meet with your physician to go through your annual exam and your annual checkup, that blood result is being generated so that when you sit down with your physician, they actually have your blood results to sit down and discuss what actions you need to take with respect to your health. Today, most patients, including you and I, never get that experience. We go into a physician's office and either our blood order is generated during the annual test, or we are required to take that blood test prior to getting to your annual test. And most of us don't adhere to it. Now you actually have the ability to get that information so that your physician can proactively sit down with you and you can get information necessary to manage your health better. And eventually, I believe that this will lead to steering patients away from having to end up in chronic care. So it's going to have a healthcare economic value. It's going to help us manage our health better. I feel like as you manage your health better, you're going to be able to live healthier, happier lives. And then in the context of the entire ecosystem that surrounds blood testing today, will reduce over time the delivery, transportation, and so on associated with blood testing and bring it to your patients. And because it is part of the journey that you take as you go to the office or go to a retail location, we will have implications over time on ESG as well. But if you take a step back and you think about big retailers and think about even Amazon, for example, so Amazon has primary care built in through their acquisition of One Medical. They have a pharmacy component through PillPack and now Amazon Pharmacy. But what's really missing is a diagnostic component that sits between and can be that connector so that you could actually go from primary care, really understand what's wrong with the patient and be able to provide an appropriate therapeutic. And that's really how we see ourselves. We're a connector in the healthcare ecosystem.
Jay, I thank you for that. And I want to come back to go-to-market a little bit later and how you think about the different customer personas that you can approach. But I want to learn a little bit more about you. So you've had over 20-year career in health innovation, and you've worked at companies with revenues ranging from $2 billion up to $30 billion. We're talking about Abbott, Genmark Diagnostics, really impressive companies. Now, what was it about Truvian that attracted you? Why did you join this company?
That's a great question. I always get asked that because obviously these were blue chip companies themselves of their own accord and had accomplished a lot in terms of healthcare, innovation, and scale. I've been building diagnostic instruments and technologies for many years, as you said, but what I hadn't had the opportunity to do was really bring something that would seminally change how healthcare is dispensed globally. I've had the opportunity to live all over the world. And what I've learned, Alex, over that period is that healthcare is a foundational human right, but yet it's not available to many. And in certain parts of the world, it isn't even available if you have the money to pay for it, which is why you end up with medical tourism and so on. And so I really felt that what Truvian presented was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me to be able to shake the foundations of how diagnostic testing, specifically blood testing, is done and be able to really participate in the journey and in this scenario, be able to lead that journey of change that's necessary for healthcare systems all over the world.
Great. So given your extensive experience in diagnostics and blood diagnostics, we've got to talk about Theranos, right? So given your experience in this space, what are your reflections on that whole saga? I'd be really keen to hear your perspective. And then are there any lessons from that which you've applied in shaping Truvian's approach?
Absolutely. I think Theranos got the thesis right. You know, the need for disruption in blood diagnostics is real. It exists to this day. The market was right. The opportunity to really be in non-traditional healthcare settings, including retail, was a great thesis that Theranos had arrived at very early in their inception. And these two have actually over time really matured. So the thesis that blood diagnostics needs to be more consumer facing and needs to occur in non-traditional environments, the pandemic just helped accelerate all of that. What we've done different from Theranos is that we really believe that experience is foundationally critical when you're trying to build anything in diagnostics, specifically in healthcare. So my co-founder and COO, Dina, and I, and others that we've built around in the organization are really experienced diagnostic personnel who bring in a lot of capabilities that are necessary for us to launch a product that is first in its class and is going to be seminal in terms of its output in the industry. But the second is we truly believe engaging regulatory bodies early and often is necessary, and we've taken that rather tactful and deliberate approach with the FDA. We engage them through a process called a pre-submission review process where they get a chance to really get our questions, our queries, and provide us much required input in order to make sure that we can go through the regulatory pathway. We've built a board and scientific advisory board. Our board has got a lot of healthcare entrepreneurs and luminaries who've actually done both innovation and scale. And that's important for us as we think about, like, how do you really go to market? And our scientific advisory board, I always state, is our North Star. They're there to ensure that we are doing the things right
And we're doing them in a manner that will ensure that we bring the right product to market. So we've taken all these steps along the way, and it is tough building a novel product. And there's a ton of engineering that needs to go to it. We've been very deliberate in that journey. So over the last 9 to 10 months, we've done multiple clinical studies, and these clinical studies are not the final FDA clinical trial, but what they've done is helped us build the muscle memory we need to be able to do the FDA trial well. And they've also allowed us to field test the product in real life settings, doing IRB approved clinical research studies, including one we just did at Health, the Health Conference in Vegas, where we were able to do an IRB sponsored study, enroll patients who were basically attendees at Health, and provide them what is the art of the possible, the fact that they could get their blood results for an annual blood test in minutes versus days.
All right. So that's killing me that I didn't go to Health. I would have loved to get my blood tested. That's so cool. How long does it take for the results to come back?
Yeah. So at Health, we had the opportunity to run a protocol that was slightly a legacy protocol. But today we're able to give you an anti-annual blood test, which is a comprehensive metabolic panel, a lipid panel, your complete blood count, basically a hematology test with a three-part diff, TSH and HbA1c for glucose. We can do all of that under 30 minutes.
Wow, that's really amazing. So you just talked a little bit about your regulatory approach at Truvian. And we have a lot of members of our audience that are part of earlier or mid-stage companies where they've got innovation, but they need to get it into the clinic. But they're thinking through their evidence generation journey, how they're going to approach trials, how they're going to engage regulators. I don't know if you've pursued any regulatory clearances overseas in Europe or otherwise, but just given your experience in this area, what advice would you give in terms to evidence generation and regulatory strategy for other entrepreneurs?
Absolutely. So we at Truvian are going to adopt a regulatory pathway that includes a traditional 510K submission because there are predicate devices that do exactly what we're doing. The tests we are doing are not novel. They're already reimbursable tests. What we're doing is we're bringing the technologies of three different instruments that would run these tests in a central lab today. We're bringing those technologies into an instrument no bigger than a desktop computer. So that's the innovation. We miniaturized three technologies, the immunoassay technology, the chemistry technology, and the hematology technologies, and we brought them into a single device. So we're going to pursue a 510K that is basically saying there are predicate devices and we're going to match them. And in our case, the predicate devices in question are central lab devices. So we're trying to match basically gold standards. We're going to follow up our 510K in parallel with what's called a CLIA waiver. A CLIA waiver would then allow us to place our product in settings where you don't need an advanced operator like an experienced med tech to run it. So we could typically place it in a physician office lab and have someone with minimal training that we provide be able to operate the instrument, and the instruments and the workflows have to demonstrate from a human factors perspective that no errors can be generated when someone with less experience is able to run a system like ours. And so we've taken that route, and the way we've approached the FDA is, like I mentioned, we take what's called the pre-sub route. So we engage the FDA, and we've done that for years now, where we've engaged them early and often, get constant feedback from them on where we are, the questions we have, how we're tackling a specific novel aspect of our product. And we ensure that they're aware of exactly how we intend to eventually submit our data to the FDA. So when they know what the breadcrumbs look like in our journey, when they get to see the final outcome, they're able to actually connect the dots during the review process. And that's critical for any entrepreneur. I would strongly advise everyone to engage with the FDA and other regulatory bodies globally. And we're thinking of being obviously outside the United States, and we're engaging those bodies as well, be it in the UK and so on. And we will engage them with the intent that they're aware of everything we do. We're going to be transparent. And when you think back about things that didn't go right in the industry, transparency was a key aspect. And we're, as Truvian, we model transparency in everything we do, and we'll continue to do that with our regulatory participants and colleagues.
Today, if you're sitting down, I challenge you to get up, go for a walk, stand up, do a jumping jack, do whatever you need to do to move, because we're joined by Dr. Phil Wagner from Sparta Science, and we're going to learn all about movement health and how employers are helping equip their teams to live healthier lives through embracing movement. Here we go. Dr. Phil Wagner from Sparta Science. I've been really looking forward to this one, but maybe we can just get started and you can let our audience know about Sparta Science and what you all do.
Yeah, so Sparta Science is a movement health platform. And what we do is we have established a platform that brings in sensor data, including one of our own native sensors, and looks at the patterns of movement from a perspective of how do we identify how to optimize human performance and limit injuries, pain, and improve the rehabilitation process.
Tell me a little bit more about movement health. What does movement health mean?
Yeah, so movement health we define as really the ability to move without pain or fear.
Why would somebody be afraid to move? What are some of the situations that they might find themselves in where this becomes a challenge?
Yeah, and you keyed in on the fear piece because pain is a little more obvious, right? If you're in pain, you don't want to move as much. And one of the interesting things we came across is we started working with athletes in sports. And in the research, there's a lot of these studies that have found kinesiophobia. So for example, athletes that tear their ACL, one of the reasons they're at risk for another injury is they're afraid to move, you know, and get hurt again. And then extending that further, we started working in the geriatric space with older individuals. And the one of the largest risks for falls is the fear of falling, right? So what happens is individuals that are older stop moving less, take shorter steps. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy where if you're scared of something happening, you actually end up making that more likely by doing less or changing the way you move.
And so what brought you to founding Sparta Science? Why are you interested in this problem and what inspired you to start the company?
Yeah, I hit both angles of the pain and the fear on that movement side as an athlete. I had dozens of different surgeries and injuries that as an athlete was really devastating because I really made a concerted effort to be healthy, kept doing things and ultimately led to the same result of being injured. Was scared of doing things because they didn't want to get injured again. It was this nasty cycle and ultimately was exposed to the lack of data and information that could help guide you into a different path. You know, like exists with things like diabetes or other chronic diseases, there's much clearer measurement and a much clearer playbook of like, okay, here's what we're trying to do. Here's what we're trying to avoid. And based on data, here are the steps to actually achieve that. But when it comes to physical therapy or fitness, it's more of a fad or subjective approach where I like doing this, or in physical therapy, pushing on my hands is a big test, right? When we think about other aspects of medicine, the fact that's a major test is something we've got to, I think, move beyond and use data to do so.
So was there a particular injury that you had that really sticks out? What I'm curious to hear about was what your journey was like going through physical therapy and how that journey might be different had the device that you've produced, if it was available at that point, how would that patient journey have been different?
Yeah, I think we all naturally in the rehab process or fitness process gravitate towards things we enjoy, right? So when I got injured, I enjoy lifting heavier weights. And so there's a number associated to it, right? Which is great. If I squat 300 pounds, like, then my goal, obviously, is to squat more than 300 pounds, right? So you keep trying to move the number. And as I tried to do that in the rehab process, I certainly became stronger, but I became stronger in a very narrow way that ultimately just heaped dysfunction on dysfunction that already existed, as opposed to using data to say, you know what? These are movements like Pilates, for example, that you, Phil, need to be doing instead to prevent these types of injuries that keep happening, right? So it's really using the data as a Sherpa, if you will, of, hey, don't take that route up the mountain. Take this route instead based on your own movement characteristics.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the force plate device that you've developed?
Yeah. So when we started looking at devices and sensors, we wanted to find the sensors or devices that were the most granular. How could we, in the shortest amount of time, capture the largest amount of data? And that's where we came across the force plate, because when we do a balance, for example, it takes about 10 seconds on each side, able to capture about 1 million data points.
Hmm.
And so that type of granularity was a data scientist's dream, right? And you get all this data in a short amount of time. It really allows you to analyze all those signals and start to create groupings or clusters that can put you into buckets on where your risks are, and more importantly, what potentially can reduce those risks. And so the force plate was real key because it allows to say, okay, let's look at one of the most common approaches, which is weighing in, right? You stand on the scale, you get your body weight. So let's use that as our pace car. And instead of just trying to get body weight, let's get 1 million other data points in that same short amount of time. Because most injuries, whether it's a fall in the elderly or an ACL injury in an athlete, most injuries have to do with the interaction with the ground. Mm. Either it's too short, too long, too left, too right. And so how do we analyze that pattern very quickly to direct the individual to a better pass?
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about some of the use cases for this technology. So we've talked a bit about MSK and recovery and rehabilitation, but what other use cases are there?
Yeah, I think one of the things that excites us about movement is we look at movement as either the cause or result of every condition. So we think about someone that does fall, they stop moving, they start putting on weight, which creates cardiovascular problems. But the opposite flow can exist as well. Whereas if you're overweight, you don't feel comfortable moving, it just increases those metabolic conditions. So I think the value of movement we look at is beyond musculoskeletal.
Mm.
So many of, we use falls as examples, are neurological. And that things like even COVID, long COVID, and delayed effects of those COVID, they affect how you balance and move in the same way that, you know, there's a lot of research that's come out that shows concussions increase your musculoskeletal injury risk. So when you have a brain or neural injury, that changes how your muscles function. So rather than looking at the cause, the musculoskeletal piece, it's really looking at all the inputs that may lead to that.
So how are you getting the device to patients today, and how do you integrate it into their provider's workflows?
Workflow is always a key issue in healthcare, right? Because patients are coming in, you have so much administrative and things to tackle in a short amount of time. And that's where that analogy of kind of the weight scale comes in. And a lot of times patients come in, they do weigh in. So why not swap that part out in the workflow of, hey, weigh in, get your body weight, but you get 1 million other data points at the same time that can then be used to not only baseline, but then track the individual every time they come into the clinic, the office, or the organization. And in the U.S. healthcare system, reimbursement's also a big piece, right, to all this. And so thankfully, balance is something that insurance companies and providers both recognize as a critical function in the rehab process, as well as in the aging process. And so it's very easy to be able to get reimbursement from this balance piece, both as a screening tool, but also as an assessment tool over time to see how that balance and that function is changing.
Hmm. Tell me about how your technology could be used in clinical trials.
Yeah, so I think a lot of times in clinical trials, pharmaceutical companies, for example, are looking at, okay, how is function changing with some sort of intervention? And ultimately, what we're trying to do is validate how different interventions impact movement. And so that can be from a pharmaceutical, because I think as we know, a lot of pharmaceuticals, one of the biggest side effects is imbalance, dizziness, right? So how does that actually impact that function? And the other piece is how do certain exercises or lifestyle changes impact movement, right? Do you really need to walk 10,000 steps a day, or is it more like 6,000, or is it 12,000? Because 10,000 steps, for example, the reason why that's a target is the first speedometer came out of Japan, and that translation is 10,000 steps. So as a result, that's been integrated into this rule of 10,000 steps a day, and that's from the 1950 speedometer out of Japan. And there's no really data behind that. In fact, most data shows, okay, you need 4,500 And about 7,500, the impact tends to level off, right? So how do we actually use assessments and data integrated to identify what are the thresholds for health? Well, because I think everybody, what everybody wants is what's the minimal amount I can do to get the maximal benefit, and looking at this functional testing to start identifying those thresholds, but also identifying which types of exercises are most important for the individual.
How important is providing feedback on the measurement itself to the patient versus just getting the measurement? So you've clearly done a lot of work in generating a lot of information and biomarkers very quickly from the core technology. How important is it to synthesize that and deliver it back to the patient in something that's interpretable and ultimately actionable?
That's huge. It's absolutely huge because medicine has evolved so much. When I was a last training as a physician, patients would always come in with printouts of WebMD, right? They would search up and ask Dr. Google, hey, what should I do about this? And they'd come in. And I bring that up because individuals have access to so much information now that any sort of assessments or information really should and must be available to that individual because they want to know. And that knowledge really is the key to compliance. Because if you want a patient to be compliant, change their habits, change their lifestyle, ultimately they have to know why. And once they know why, they also want to see over time, if they do change those things, am I getting better? Because the frustrating part is if you make lifestyle changes, if you make habit changes, and you don't get that immediate feedback, it's very easy to give up on that. Like, why am I even doing this? It's not even working. And that's why so many patients leave physiotherapy too early, because they don't really know if they're getting better, even though they probably are. So being able to share that information back to the patient, back to the individual, really completes that feedback loop, because where medicine is evolving is the practitioner and the individual, it's more of a partnership now than it used to be. And so that kind of centralized language in a very simple manner is very key to that process of individuals getting better.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast for part two of our five-part mini-series focused on health innovation. In the coming weeks, we'll feature clinical trials, clinician and patient experience, real-world evidence, and population health. So don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss our latest episodes. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please really don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.